Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and it is Tony Award season, and I am thrilled to welcome Tony Award nominees Eric De La Penna and David Yazbek, who are nominated for Best Score for Dead Outlaw. Welcome, guys.
Hey, Eric, how do you feel right now, like physically?
Physically?
Yeah.
I feel like I've had not enough caffeine. I feel like maybe I'm either getting sick or I have allergies.
Well, you know what I think it is?
What?
Tony fever.
Oh, you're right.
See, I was just leading up to the punchline there.
I like yesterday when you mentioned you hate when people use refer to something as a journey.
It's one of those tropes. I'm just sick of it. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's not a journey. It's a celebration. It's just fun. They're supposed to be fun.
My theater journey, my Tony journey.
You know, it's really fun sometimes to write the stuff, and it's incredibly fun to see an audience respond positively.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really fun to see your friends and collaborators who you've worked with and met, you know, and some you know very well, some a little less well over the last, you know, two decades working in theater. But it's not fun sitting for 4 hours in a row, you know, listening to self-congratulatory, you know, sort of money producers talk about themselves.
Right. I've heard that from so many people. I've heard people always tell me the time frame from the date of the nominations up to the evening of the actual award ceremony are a lot of fun because you do get to celebrate and see people. But the award ceremony themselves is like the worst part. Because it's just it's a very long evening of awards, and it's not as much fun as the stuff leading up to it.
And there's nothing you can do. You have no control over it. That's the thing.
Like
if you're prone to anxiety or severe boredom, you sit there and there's just nothing you can do. You can't even leave, like, because you're a nominee. what happens if you win? You know.
Right. So. Right. And you guys am I correct? You guys just did a rooftop concert last night, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How was that? That looked fun.
I thought it was great fun. What did you think, Eric?
I did think it was fun. Did it seem like I wasn't having fun?
No, I can never tell with you. You're always kind of squinting and like, you always look like you're thinking really hard.
I was concerned about sound. I was concerned about guitar not being loud enough. I was concerned about the other guitar being not.
But you didn't trust me because I like went out front. I was like,
you did. You saved it by being pleasant and fun and.
No,
and
but I also like I also worked the sliders on the, you know, I turned one guitar down. I turned the other.
All right, good.
I was trying to handle that.
I know that. The woman who was helping us was doing that, so I was hoping that it went as good. You know, it was a quick thing. It was on a roof, and there was a purpose for.
I love that kind of thing because it's the stakes. While the stakes are in a way they're high because you know our publicist, it's their roof, and our producers, it's their money to buy the shrimp and the sliders and you know whatever's going around.
It was shrimp.
Oh yeah, but they were dry. I didn't like the shrimp, but the sliders were good. You know, but so there are stakes because it is, you know, after all, it's like a Tony voter roof party,
mm-hmm.
meaning let's just, you know, everyone else is doing stuff. Why don't we do stuff too? So everyone remembers our show. Like that's what it's for.
Yeah.
But then instead of a full band, it's just one or two guitars. If you screw something up, it's fine. There's Eric and me singing songs that we used to sing all the time, but now other people sing it. There's, you know, Julia Nitell with her beautiful voice, and it's very intimate, and people get to hear her and see her very up close. There's Andrew Duran with his beautiful voice. So I just love that kind of thing. It's just a different way of delivering the songs, you know?
Right.
Right. And the most important thing is when you were looking out at the audience, were they smiling and having a good time?
Yes, they were. Well, they were really, really into
right.
it. It was a very friendly audience.
Right. Fun. And so, Eric, you don't need to be worrying about whether the guitars sounded good or how the sound was. If the audience was smiling and having a good time, that's what matters.
You're right.
Yeah, right. I mean, I'm remembering like when Eric plays in my band and he plays in his own band like all the time, and I'm just remembering times when I might say something like, "Oh, I'm gonna forget lyrics on this song or that song," and you just go, "Ah, they love you. Just do whatever you do, they're gonna love you." And I felt like that's how it was last night. Whatever any of us did, they would love it.
Right,
you're right. I just enjoy being uptight and kind of sucking all the energy out of the room. That's my thing.
It's his hobby and his passion. It's your journey.
It's your journey. There we go. We're back to the journey word.
That Indian train is filled with money. It's harvest time for you and me. We'll climb right in like bears to honey. And all that we leave is the empty tree. All that we leave is the empty tree. That Indian train with all that money. They won't see a dime if it's up to me. We're poor, that just ain't funny. We're taking it back, let the white man be. Taking it back, let the white man be. Indian gold. We'll be miles away.
We'll be miles away when the sun is gone.
Let's talk a little bit about Elmer McCurdy, since Ooh. he's sort of the journey about which this show is focused on. Mm. Talk a little bit for people who do not know what Dead Outlaw is about. Talk a little bit about the original event, way back in 1976.
Oh, okay.
That started this, because I grew up here in Los Angeles, and I grew up in the city of Downey, which is not very far from Long Beach. So I remember this very, very well. I remember all the news coverage when this event happened. So talk a little bit about the event and why it intrigued you and why this many decades later it suddenly turned into a musical.
I love whenever we meet someone who remembers the story. Original,
I remember Eyewitness News, Channel 7. I remember the coverage of people were like, "Oh my God, this funhouse body turned out to be real because the arm fell off and a bone was sticking out."
Well, we just ruined the whole story. The story. So I was told the story, you know, like 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I was told it by a friend who I had been to college with, a musician, writer, a guy that I hung out with a lot. He told me the story, and he knew it because his mother, when it happens, started sending him newspaper clippings. He didn't live at home at the time, even though he was 16. You know, his mother lived in another, maybe she lived in Southern California and he lived in Massachusetts. Anyway, he told me this story, and the story begins in 1976. We're in a indoor dark funhouse ride at the New Pike Amusement Park in Long Beach, California. This is a ride, this is a House of Horrors type ride where you go on a cart and various, you know, scary things pop up. Mm-hmm. And so the $6 million Man TV show starring Lee Majors, who at the time was married to Farrah Fawcett, these are things you need to know, was shooting a remote shoot at this amusement park inside this ride. This is one of the reasons why it was a national story briefly, because it was $6 million Man. Mm-hmm. They're preparing the set, meaning the location, and a Teamster, who is actually a guy that I met a few years ago and talked to, a Teamster sees this day-glow orange, what looks like a wax dummy, hanging by a noose against a wall. Someone tells him, can you just, let's lose that. You know, that doesn't look good. So as he's approaching it, he realizes, wait a minute, that looks really weird. That doesn't look like something's wrong about that. He goes to move it, and the arm comes off in his hand. And what he sees inside the shoulder is a bone. And he realizes this is not a wax dummy. This is a man. They whisk the, I want to say mummy, but I'm just going to say they whisk the body off to the county coroner, who says, you know, who has a mystery that he has to deal with. And that's sort of the story. It's who is this guy? Let's flashback to Thiersmont, Maine, 1880. Elmer McCurdy is born. And his life is basically the life of a recidivist, a criminal, eventually an alcoholic. He has a chance at redemption for a few years. There's a little bit of a love story. He blows it. Maybe it's because of his addiction. Maybe it's just because of his nature. But he resumes the life of an itinerant criminal. And eventually he's shot by a posse. Now, he dreamed of fame and wealth when he was alive. His last act was to rob a train. He tended to come away with very little or nothing from his criminal behaviors. And in this case, he came away with almost nothing, and he was shot by a posse. Now his career in show business begins, and it's really like an amazing career. His body ends up desiccating at the coroner's office back in Pawhuska, Oklahoma. And the body is eventually bought and starts being exhibited in sideshows, eventually in silent movies. The body is traded, bought, left behind, forgotten. His name becomes completely forgotten. He ends up a day-glow orange dummy hanging in an amusement park. Mm-hmm. And this is the act one is about his life. It's a one-act play, but, you know, Part one is about his life, and Andrew Duran sings like six songs, like one after the other, and he knocks it out of the park. Then he's dead, and Andrew Duran is in a coffin for the entire second part, not moving, and he doesn't sing again until the end. Mm-hmm. So that's really the story is looking into what this type of very American character is. Like, who is this guy? What is he driven by? What are we driven by? Then he's dead. And then the questions all become, what is this exploitation of this body? What's the fascination of a mummy or a dead body, whether it be an Egyptian mummy in a museum or, you know, a picture of a dead body taken by Ouija in the 30s. You know, what is this fascination? Is it about our own mortality? So you're laughing. The music can get very loud. You know, it can also be, you know, beautiful and ballads. But the whole time you're being entertained, there's something going on underneath that. And that's what you're left with after the show. You're left with a lot of earworms that you're listening, that you're hearing in your head. And you're left with the Zen koan question mark that's stamped in your heart.
What drove you to think, okay, this is the perfect subject for a musical? And secondly, what brought you? I know you knew Eric and had worked in a collaborative with Eric. But what brought you to kind of pull Eric into the project to collaborate with you?
Well, what hooked me in terms of it being a musical was simply that, you know, I'm a songwriter. The story had been in me for 30 years, never figured out a way to get it out, you know, Eric and I have been playing together for at least 20 years, and I told him the story, and it just sort of naturally happened that it was like, well, why don't we try, let's write a few songs. And it wasn't even thinking about a few songs for a musical. It was just a few songs because we're both singer-songwriters too, you know, like, you know, and we'd written songs together and played together. So, but once we started that process, the easiest foot that I can put in any door to deliver the ideas of the story is musical theater, because that's where I've had my most success. So Eric and I discussed, you know, what can this be? Can this be a musical? Well, let's see. And we got Itamar Moses involved. He wrote a narrative that I read from a book when we tried to, you know, like he had written basically the spine of the whole show, and we started performing the songs as a band with Eric and me singing everything, including female parts. And we invited Cromer, and then Itamar and Cromer discussed, and the two of us discussed broadening it into something with a full cast. And, you know, so Eric came in because it was pretty organic. His field of expertise, though he's extremely eclectic as I am, his field of expertise, or at least, you know, when we're playing together, is that kind of genre of Americana blues, early jazz, you know, like early 20th century jazz. But we're also, you know, AC/DC fans and Led Zeppelin fans and stuff. And it just was very natural, very organic that we should start writing it together. And I just knew it would be fun to write with him also. So I've answered that question, but I've done all the talking.
Yes, Eric. Eric, what did you think?
Oh, I'm exhausted now.
Yeah, I'm sorry, man.
What did I think about what?
About the, well, when he brought this to you and brought and told you the story, what were you thinking?
Well, I was excited. I was ready to go. There was no hemming and hawing. I love the story, and but you know, he had bigger, more successful journeys.
There's that word.
Theater. And this idea was sort of an indulgence. It was not, what's the term that I've heard thrown around now? IP?
Well, it's different for IP. You. Right. Yes.
Because, it was not IP. So, right.
Because David, everything you've worked on has had existing IP behind it. And this is an original idea, a totally original idea.
Right. So people are going to be less inclined, I think. People who produce shows are probably going to be less inclined to want to take a risk on something like that. And that's just the reality of the business. Mm-hmm. So the idea, though I was excited, I reserved some doubt that it would ever happen. And as the years wound on, it was not even in my, I was not counting it. I was not counting my chickens before they were hatched. It was not even one of my chickens after a while. It was something I would need to be reminded of. Oh, right. I remember when you brought that up. Yes.
And now it's your plumpest, biggest chicken.
Right.
Yeah.
That's just I'm still amazed at how, for better or for worse, life takes not predict.
Right.
And then you die. And then you die.
Look at the dead man. Nothing to no one. No one is coming to take him away. He used to be something. Now he's just nothing. Nothing but something that's taking up space. But a wise man said, if you slowly, try not to shake him, don't want to break him, now into the box, give him a rifle, prop him up proud, proud little dead man, good paradox, see the bad, bad man, for a mere 2 bits you can, see the dead outlaw.
To me, musical theater seems to be the natural fit for the story. It seems to be the natural fit for this show because, in a way, the whole story of Elmer McCurdy is the first thing. Because I saw the show when I was in New York 3 weeks ago. I actually saw it the evening of the morning Tony nominations were announced. So I saw it that night.
That's the best time to see a show.
It's the best time to see the show because the cast and the band were just like on fire. Because yeah. It was like 7 Tony nominations and they were like beside themselves.
Little did they know that a month later they'd just be exhausted shows.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
But it's the kind of show, because it reminded me when I saw it, I mean, I knew enough about it going in that I knew sort of what to expect. But it reminds me of sort of the American tall tales, the folk tales of sort of bigger than life stories that sort of seem to be, you would think they're so crazy and wild that you would think they're sort of fictionalized in some way, but this one is not. But it lends itself to this kind of storytelling narrative that the show utilizes with the band and using the leader of the band, Jeb Brown, to tell the story, to narrate the story, and the type of music, the kind of folk rock vibe that you get from the show lends itself really well to storytelling. And that's what the show kind of is in the way it's presented. And I think it works really well for this plot and with these characters and the way it's staged. I think it fits perfectly into this genre. So, you know, I think that making this into a musical makes perfect sense.
That's like, I wonder if you'd be saying the same thing like 3 years ago. In other words, like if I were just to tell you the story and then you'd, because years and years ago, I thought about maybe this is something like, maybe this is a musical. And I talked to a couple of friends of mine who are writers, including mm-hmm. someone I'd written a bunch of different scripts with and I worked very well with. And he's thinking about it. He's going, that's the most amazing story I've ever heard. And then he's like, there's a silence. And then he says, you know, Dave, you know what the problem is? Your main character's dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, yeah, how are you going to do that? Is he in heaven? Is he looking at from heaven? Is he? And it took our little village of four to figure it out. Like, we went in with instincts that once he's dead, we can write, he can be sort of a presence, but really what it becomes about is American ambition, greed, mm-hmm. hunger, you know, sort of, it's about the people who exploit or have contact with his mummy. And that's when it gets really deep, but also really fun because you have mm-hmm. all these different crazy American characters. We all sort of knew that was going to work. We didn't know how, and we bumped into a lot of walls on the way there. But I'm so glad that it feels to you like it's part of that tall tale genre, because I think people respond to that. They realize they're seeing a very, very American story told in a completely original way. Yeah. And I, you know, me, if I, as an audience member, you know, that I just get so excited about something original where the music is something I like and the storytelling is exciting because it's original. Like, I felt that way when I went and saw A Strange Loop. Mm-hmm. You know, I couldn't stop talking about it, not because I loved the songs or anything like that, because he pulled off this feat of autobiographical storytelling on stage that I'd never seen really work before. And that got me going. Like, that really got me going. So I'm hoping, and what I'm seeing is that the way we pulled off this story gets a lot of people going.
Right. Well, I think the thing is, it's very funny. It's very original. It's got, like you said, crazy characters, but the themes that you're tackling are so interesting and so very American. It's this ambitious drive that is kind of been instilled in the culture of, we all want, there's this strive to be famous. There's a strive to leave some sort of legacy for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody wants to leave some sort of legacy and become famous and be known for something and be remembered for something. But there's two sides to that, which is you can do all these things while you're alive. And some people succeed and some people fail. But ultimately, in the end, death is kind of the great leveler, because everybody's going to die. And ultimately, it doesn't matter what you did, because you're all going to be dead. And whatever legacy you leave behind sometimes also doesn't matter, because once you're dead, you don't have any control over your legacy, because it can be exploited and changed and fictionalized and twisted into whatever the people who are still alive want it to be. So,
yeah.
You know, so whatever legacy you leave behind may not be the legacy you intended. Or what, you know, it's so
everything
it's,
you're saying, everything you're saying now. So you watch the show, it's an hour and 40 minutes, whatever yeah, it is, no yeah. intermission. You watch the show, you don't really think about what you're just talking about now. What you oh. are doing is you're following it, you're being affected by it. You mm-hmm. leave the theater and your subconscious is just going crazy working out what you're talking about right now.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then you talk about it, then you discuss it with people, and it's like exactly the kind of experience that I want from a piece of art.
But that makes it a good show, because it's a show that makes you think and makes you experience something.
I have to agree that it's a good show.
Yeah, of course. I hope you agree. But yeah, that's why I love the show so much, because while you're sitting there being entertained and being wowed by the band and by the actors and by the music, when you leave the theater, you want to take away something with you. And
yeah.
there's a lot of shows that once you step out and as soon as you walk a block, it's completely dissipated and gone.
Yeah. Know? There's really great value in seeing a show that just takes you
out of
reality for 2 hours or whatever it is.
Of course.
But for me, that's not worth the price of admission, really. For me,
right.
at this point in my life, it's kind of like, give me something that is thought provoking. Tremendously funny. You know, it's like the difference between a stand-up, you know, like someone like Sarah Silverman, or, you know, like stand-ups who like there's levels working. You're laughing mm-hmm. really hard, but there's levels working, you know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. political, spiritual, whatever. Or just a stand-up who makes, you know, you go to a club and they make you laugh and then you leave and that's it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So, Eric, talk about the collaboration you have with David in terms of actually writing these songs, because, and talk about the musical influences and the genres you're covering, because the score, I want people to realize if they haven't seen the show or listened to the tracks that have been released so far, what different musical genres you guys are touching on in the show, because it is a wide range of musical styles in this score.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think we're both children of the 70s and 80s, and we grew up around this urban area of NYC. You can hear a lot of different types of music, all different types of music. So there's a lot to choose from. There's a lot of sounds being drummed into your head as a young person watching television, local TV. There's records available. There's, you know, there's the music of our generation, the folk music of suburban America, whether it's AC/DC or Led Zeppelin or the Ramones or Lou Reed or Duran Duran. So I think that's where we're coming from. We're also thinking about America in a sort of Steinbeckian, Woody Guthrie, Moby Dick perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's informing, I think, how we're telling this story.
Right. You're also having to write it to be very character specific, because that's one of the things that's really nice about the score, is that it is the stuff that Elmer / Andrew sings is very, I think he's definitely got the toughest things to sing in the show because right. of the it, range it, of what does. He's singing.
It is character specific, but I think like most art, you can't get away. Yes, it's him and his character, but it's also us as songwriters. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think that's what great songwriters do.
Did you just call us great songwriters? Is that what you just did?
I did. I will not back off of
that. I'm not pussyfooting around.
Well, yeah. Hey, he has a Tony nomination. He can say that now.
It's true. And Eric is certainly a great songwriter, no question. And I would recommend to anyone any of his Kill Henry Sugar albums. That's the band that he has with our friend Dean. You know, available streaming.
And I also wanted to point out that the band is on stage, and that's part there, and they're a character in the show, which is really important to way the show is staged. And talk about how that that concept and I'm assuming that was obviously in collaboration with David Cromer, right?
Well, you know, because the show kind of started as a band show with our band. Mm-hmm. With Eric and me, the aforementioned Dean, another guitar player and a bass player, because it sort of began its life that way with that narrative that Itamar wrote that I read, when Cromer first saw it performed in that sort of draft example, you could just sort of see that he had an idea almost immediately. And his big idea was, all right, there's a stage within the stage, mm-hmm. and the band is on that stage, and that stage can move anywhere on the stage. Like that's one of those ideas that open everything up. Mm-hmm. So his second idea was, you know, what you just said, the band is a character. So the narrator is the band leader, just as I came off as the band leader / narrator. When we did it, mm-hmm. Eric was in the off-Broadway production as the sort of one of the lead singers of the band. This was all just ways to help us imagine the thing. But then Cromer, you know, like he gave everyone guns so that when there was like a train robbery, everyone in the band could just like raise their gun, you know?
Right.
Like, I mean, just like with Band's Visit, Cromer was the sort of visionary mm-hmm. glue to what we had written.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and he also uses the band and the band the band stand technically as a platform, so that because there are moments where the characters themselves who are not in the band take their place on the bandstand in front of a microphone to sing.
Yes. And there's always a reason behind it. And
right,
I love that. You know, Cromer, he's just how he sees things. When when Julia, you know, is singing, she's sort of identifying the body
right
at the coroner's in the early 20th century, and she's singing this very lovely, and God, her voice is her voice is so beautiful. You know, when she's doing that, she sings a verse looking at the body, and then she sort of goes over to the bandstand, and then she's basically Linda Ronstadt singing to us.
To see him here today, without shoes, without a smile, it's hard to reconcile with the man who was to me. He came into my life with his broken disposition. I had my suspicion, he remained a mystery. A stranger, a stranger, hoping for a future in our dusty little town. A stranger, a stranger. He could never settle down. It hasn't been that long since I've been without him. There's not much about him I can recollect or tell. A picnic in the rain, a walk we may have taken, but I could be mistaken, I don't remember well. A strange together, talking about whether we should prune the cherry tree. At the kitchen table, could you pass the gravy? Should we have a baby? It was never gonna be. A stranger, a stranger held me in his arms not so very long ago. Stranger, stranger, the man I was to marry was a man I didn't know.
One of the reasons I love that is because one of the things that I find myself saying to actors in most of my shows who are singing is, could you just sing it like you're singing it at a gig? like, you know, not a cabaret gig, like a band gig. Like, right. Can you just not adorn it with everything you learned at Carnegie Mellon, you know? And that's right up Cromer's alley. So yeah, for me, it's just wonderful to be able to, same thing happens with the coroner, the Pawhuska coroner,
right.
You know, when he gets up on that bandstand, he's a rock star. He's not a coroner. And he sings it that way.
I really love that piece of it because I like the fact that the actors do take their place sort of as the band singer. And because Andrew does that also.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to give anything away, but it's a rather wild moment in the show. Don't say anything. I don't want to spoil that for the audience.
I can't wait till people start hearing that song away from the show, you know?
Yeah. But I want to talk about casting too a little bit, because I think the casting of the show is sort of like the final piece that makes everything else really gel on stage for this production.
Yeah.
And that is that, because you're dealing with characters in the show that are so flawed and unusual, that having this cast, this specific cast, who are such distinctive, unique performers, is what makes this work. I mean, from Andrew to Julia to Tom to Jeb to Eddie Cooper to, they are all such.
Don't forget Ken.
Right.
My fave.
They are such distinctive, unique performers.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing, is that these characters in the show, as flawed and crazy as they are, they're all so deeply human that the audience feels for them in a lot of ways. I mean, we really do feel for Elmer. He's such a loser.
Yeah.
In so many ways, and such a failure at so many things that you can't help but feel for him. And you have to have the right person playing Elmer. And Andrew is that kind of person.
Well, I can pat myself on the back for Andrew, because I went and saw Shucked, which was written by Robert Horn, who I wrote Tootsie with, who's, you know, like a very close friend, and who, you know, I think is one of the funniest guys in the world. And I went and saw it. I'm sitting there and I just saw Andrew. I was like, that's Elmer. That's our Elmer. There he is. And so that one, you know, I knew that if we brought him in, all of us would say, yeah, that's him.
Right.
Our casting director, Peter Van Damme, did a spectacular job with this, like a non-lazy, you know, not just throwing this massive fishnet out. Like, he really understood what Itamar and what Cromer and what we wanted in as far as acting style, these people have to be very versatile, because sometimes they're extremely human and sort of their actions are small, but their emotions are real. And sometimes they're just complete caricatures.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be able to do everything in between. And everybody in this show can do that. So that's sort of a interesting, you know, challenge for a casting director and a director.
Right. And whoever did it, it's spectacular, because
I agree.
Every person on that stage is so perfectly cast, and they are people that you have never seen before. I mean, I knew Andrew from Head Over Heels is where I first saw him. And then obviously in Shucked, but he's just such a unique performer and unique leading man type that he's not a cardboard cutout of every, you know, leading man type on Broadway.
No.
And Julia is so unique, and Julia is so versatile, and she's got such a gorgeous voice that's so different from everybody else on Broadway. And
you know what they all have in common is they're all very smart.
Yeah.
You know, like nobody rests on tricks or techniques. And to talk to and communicate with a director like Cromer, you'd better be smart, because he's the smartest guy in the room, you know? So you have to understand what the style, you know, what it's always the first thing is tone, you know, whether whether it's visual tone or the acting style or the singing style. And not all of them would naturally lean towards the tone that the show is, but all of them have the capacity to understand what the tone is and then lean towards it, you know, like to do it.
Right. And I have to tell you, when I got out of the show, one of the first things I said was, this is like the casting and the tightness of the cast and the way the cast really worked and how well cast it was reminded me so much of The Band's Visit.
Well,
it just did, because that was another show where the cast was so perfect.
Yeah,
and so
I'm not surprised.
And I'm sure it's some of it's Cromer and some of it's just the eye for picking the right kind of people and the right performers for each role.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a cliche that if you're a director, 80% of your job is done if you cast it correctly.
Exactly.
But it's especially hard with musicals because you also need singers, but you don't want them to, you know, both for Band's Visit and for Dead Outlaw, you don't want them to sound like legit Broadway singers. That just doesn't fit the tone.
Right. I also wanted to really do a quick shout out because I know we are a little pressed for time, but I also wanted to do a quick shout out just to the whole Broadway season. This season, especially a lot of the best musical nominees, I think like 4 out of the 5 nominees are all very focused on storytelling and very focused on the use of sort of the use of narrators and the use of small casts to tell their stories. Like Buena Vista Social Club, which I know, David, you're also involved with that show or have been involved with that show.
Yeah.
And maybe Happy Ending and Operation Mincemeat, how they're all using small casts, innovative staging. And it's just so nice to see theater being done this way on Broadway.
Yeah, it's sort of like...
And a lot of dead bodies, a lot of corpses.
Well, it's about time.
It's about time.
I mean,
it's time the dead are rising on Broadway.
I think part of that might be the exigencies of just the financial, you know, the financials. But if that's what makes you dig deep for quality and for originality, then it's worth it, you know, as opposed to saying, well, damn it, how do we, you know, how big should the helicopter be that we land?
Right.
You know, it's not financially viable to do King Kong. Well, it wasn't even then, but you know what I'm saying? Like, how about some great music and some great storytelling and 15 people on stage instead of 35. Yeah.
It's people stretching their creative muscles and really doing it. And also also the actors are loving it because they're really getting to push themselves.
Yes.
And it shows on stage. It really does.
This cast, they just show up to stuff, all of them together. Like they all respect each other's ability to do it, but also their willingness to do it. There's very little ego getting in the way of just, it's like a really great band, you know, just like, let's just make the best thing we can make.
Right.
And I sense that, you know, we met the Mincemeat folk and I sense that with them, like they're an ensemble who, you know, they're just all about creating something.
When the stars are bright like these stars, so they almost hurt your eyes. Like maybe God is singing you a song, singing you a song. And the cottonwoods are whistling, and the owls and frogs join in. The breeze in your hair, the honeysuckle air. All there, they sing, all there. The sky is black, but filled with diamonds. You can almost hold them in your hand. And up there, God is preaching, laughing while you're reaching. And that's what no one ever seems to understand. When the wind is warm like this wind, it reminds you who you are. The dew, it appears just like grateful tears. I'm here. Thank you.
the dew, it appears, just like grateful tears. I'm here, I'm here, I'm here, ooh, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here.
I also wanted to talk to you both about the opening of the show, because it's so important. The opening of the show, writing an opening of a show, the opening numbers of a show is so important, because especially when you're dealing with a show that is an original like this, where you have an audience that doesn't know what they're coming into for the most part. And the way your show opens is so, I think, so brilliantly done with the ballad that Andrew gets to sing leading into the big number for the band. Talk about give me some quick thoughts on how that kind of all comes together, because it really is a smart way to get the kind of the character and tone of the show and the kind of the ride you're going to take the audience on.
Eric Della Penna.
Well, this came about really quickly. I think I'm not sure which came first. Yazbek's idea of
I had imagined a guy singing.
Oh yeah, that was it. You had the guy, a guy singing a song.
That's been in my head for like 15 years, like a guy under the stars. But it came up because you showed me that video of the residents on television.
Right, they're standing around a campfire.
Yeah, like there was a number by this band called the Residents. It's very evocative, even though it was kind of weird and performance arty. But there was a campfire involved and these kind of puppet people with giant cowboy hats, and that just stuck something in my head. And I really, really always knew that there should be a beautiful, beautiful ballad followed by "Let's Go Rob a Train."
But you said you had the whole line. Let's go rob that fucking train.
Let's go rob that fucking train. But then, so now continue with where you were at.
Then I took a crack at the tune of what that campfire song, that campfire music would be. I handed it off to, I did it on slide guitar. I played the whole melody on slide guitar and the chords. And I passed it off to Yazbek, and then he wrote the lyrics and it all happened fairly quickly. And that was the entrance into the tune. And shortly thereafter, Dead became the contrast, the counterpoint to that ballad.
That was like, that's kind of a magical songwriting moment. Like we wrote all these 14, 15 songs in very different ways, you know, in various ways. And this was one of those ones where he just came up with basically all the music, including humming the melody. And it was so evocative to me that it took me half an hour, you know, like almost no time to write all the lyrics. You know, we did some songs together, playing at the same time. We sort of did some songs back and forth. Lennon and McCartney did a lot, but that was a very encouraging sort of start to things.
I think I saw a lot of shows on my most recent trip, and I think it's the best opening of a show.
No, thank you.
I really do. Because it's just so perfectly put together, and it ultimately, because you really need an opening number, again, especially with an original musical where the people, where there's no, you know, underlying intellectual property that people know.
Yeah.
It's got to be a number that's going to set the tone and kind of get things kickstarted.
Yep.
And that's exactly what that number does.
And yeah, it's all about tone. It's all about setting the tone.
And it absolutely nails it.
But what really sets the tone after you get that tone, then he says, "All right, boys, let's go rob that fucking train." As soon as he says that,
exactly,
then you're really set up for the show, because you know, and then the band launches into this really rollicking song, but then the song is about death.
Exactly.
And you're just like, this is the show I'm about to get.
Yeah.
And you're ready for it. You're ready for the ups and the downs, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it really does work.
It's perfect. As I think I briefly mentioned, seven of the songs from the cast recording have been released, and we have more coming in the fall, the complete recording coming in the fall.
Maybe earlier. We're not sure.
Oh, That would be a nice surprise.
I hope so.
Is this going to be the complete show, or is it going to be just songs? Because I believe that didn't they record the whole show at some point?
There's two things going. So it's audible, right? So
yeah.
their end game is, you know, eventually to have some product on their platform. And Dean Sharinow and I, Dean's the music supervisor, but also has co-produced the records, almost all the records that Eric and I have made. And he and I got into the studio with the cast and with the band, and we recorded basically what amounts to a cast album with the band.
Mm-hmm.
It really sounds like a rock. It doesn't sound like a cast album. It sounds like a rock and roll album. And then we brought the cast in for full control. You know, we had them in the studio instead of in the theater, and then we recorded the show with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then put it together so that it is the show, including reprises, including stuff that happens within songs. It is an audio version of the show. We did some changes so that you could, you know, so visual stuff could become,
right,
you know, verbal. That will come out. I don't know if it'll come out in the summer or the fall. I'm looking forward to it because it's really amazing. It's an Atmos mix and it's immersive. It's just, I've never heard anything like it. It's very cool. But the cast album is its own thing. And we took the same songs, but mixed them differently, mastered them differently, and in some cases recorded them differently. And that's more like just an album with 14 bangers, I hope.
Oh, cool. Okay. Yeah. So question for each of you individually. Do you have a favorite moment in the show? And it doesn't have to be a song. It could just be a scene or a line delivery or something. I know for me, looking back, I think my favorite moment in the show might be Normal. Just because, one, it's such a great song, but it's also such a hopeful song. But at the same time, it's got this underlying sense of melancholy because you know that Elmer is never really going to have a normal life. And it just is never really going to happen for him. But for you guys, do you guys have, each of you, a specific moment that you think is like your favorite moment in the show?
I like in My Dear Brother when the two brothers whistle and uh-huh. whittling. I just, the whittling is just comes out of nowhere because they need to convince that they need to pull on the heartstrings of this undertaker who wants to get rid of Elmer's body, but they conjure this tale of how he used to whittle wood and whistle while he whittled, and they all whistle and whittle. There's this
yes,
heartfelt imagery. That I like that.
And okay. They're just pulling it out of their asses. That's right. They're
pulling out of their asses, and you don't see any whittling.
No.
There's no whittling.
No.
I love to whittle. Yeah. And also, it makes what Elmer was, who was this raging alcoholic...
It's absurd. It's just absurd.
Yeah. And he's just there, like a simpleton, whittling and
right.
Couldn't be more innocent and
simpleton.
Yes.
For me, like it changes. For a long time, it was the moment, and I had this moment in my head from a very early point of the coroner to the stars, Thomas Noguchi, because I've seen all those episodes of Quincy and, you know, scenes of coroners, and there's always a microphone hanging over the body.
Yes.
because they're saying like what they're doing, and I always had this image of him reaching up and grabbing the mic and starting to sing like a Sinatra kind of swinging number. And every time that happens, when he grabs the microphone that's hanging over the corpse, that gets me. But I think there's just this moment in that song. This is really weird, where I've told her this a couple of times, where Julia Nitel, who you've already seen be a, you know, his girlfriend back in Iola, Kansas, she's played a single character who ages over the period of, you know, like 10 or 15 years. She's played a million different parts, but during the Thomas Noguchi swinging number, at some point, she comes out with a autopsy table that he jumps on while he's singing, And she's in like a beautiful, long, sparkly gown. And she just is pushing it around like a showgirl in Las Vegas. And the faces she's making, it's like the model on Let's Make a Deal.
Right.
When she's showing you the Broyhill furniture, like it just cracks me up every time. It's such a little moment. It has nothing to do with singing. It's just visual, but it just gets me every time.
Okay. Okay. So let's, and just to leave our listeners with this one last question. What can we all learn from Elmer and his life, and maybe more importantly, his death?
Well, can I start, Eric?
Yes.
You know, there's a lot you can learn on different levels. For me, the most important item, and you sort of referred to this earlier, is this idea of, if you are thinking about legacy, quote unquote, if you're putting your name on buildings, or if you're thinking, oh, I just got to do something to be remembered because it gives you the sense that you're not going to die. Well, you're not living in the moment, and there's no way you're going to be happier living in a non-existent future or past than you would be if you were just engaged in the present moment. And if you're engaged in the present moment, it's really hard to be a criminal, you know? It's really hard because what are you aspiring to? So there's a song called Crimson Thread at the end of the show, and it's a series of questions. What is the thread that pulls you through all the months and years? You know, invisible thread. Is it the desire? Is it, you know, those questions, if you ask them to yourself enough, the answer is always the same, which is just pay attention right now. Pay attention. And that's what I hope, you know, at some level people are left with.
Eric?
I think he's covered everything. I would just add that, yeah, I mean, it's just a reminder that if we could all suck a little less, this would be a much more habitable planet.
Very, very well put.
Yep.
Very well put.
I'll buy that.
Yeah. Well, thank you both. I really appreciate you guys taking the time to chat with me today. And all the best for the rest of this Tony Fever season. Please enjoy. And all the best on Tony night, and try and have a good time, even though it's a bit painful to sit through.
I've heard that for 25 years. It's never the case, but thank you.
Try and have a good time.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for talking to us.
Thanks, Donald.
Born with nothing, your cheeks are apple dumplings, the air, the water, there's something more you want, the milk, the sugar, outside you there's a layman, you came with nothing, you'll leave it just the same, but
between the dark and the darkies, the voice you're always hearing, some crazy auctioneer is yelling at you, then you walk, you run, you flee the dark and see the sun, and every brick you ever labeled crumble away, your mom is dead,
your daddy's dead.
Your brother's dead.
And so are you.
Abe Lincoln's dead.
Frank James dead.
Your mom is dead.
And so are you. And so are you.
Woo!
Your adolescence was just an open presence. You drank the liquor. Those dead ancestors, you had to make an exit. You went and found the bottle, and now your face reflects it.
Yeah, so you fell with failures, and you confront your rivals. You stand there armed with Bibles pointing at you. Then you plot, you scheme. You had a chance, had a dream. Couldn't get a witness, now you stand here today. Your mom is dead.
John Gotti's dead.
Dillinger's dead.
And so are you.
Balzac is dead.
Tupac is dead.
And Frank is dead.
And so are you, and so are you. I've been a pilgrim on the road from coast to coast. I look around and all I see was hungry ghosts. Getting and spending all
gravel road through hell. I know the drill, cause I'm one of them as well. Your wild desire, and all you must acquire, more love, more money. But don't you find it funny?
And still you're hungry. In fact, you're really famished. The craving and the panic until the day you vanished.
You just keep pushing pushers. You just keep cheating cheaters like those religious leaders tell you to do. So you kick, you scream. You hear the graduation theme. Jehovah calls your name and then she takes you away. Babe Ruth is dead. George Custer's dead. Black Elk is dead. And so are you.
Joe Young is dead. Bert Cotter's dead. Glenn Gould is dead. And so are you.
Your mama's dead. Your daddy's dead. They're all just dead. And so are you. Look at them dead. Look at me dead. Look at you dead. And so are you. And so are you.